The Republican-dominated Ohio ballot board made tweaks this week to the language voters will see describing an amendment that would change redistricting. Supporters of the amendment, known as Issue 1, say the ballot language is meant to hoodwink voters. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll discuss Issue 1 and the arguments over the new ballot language. We'll also hear about a new vision for a renovated Paycor Stadium and the hefty price tag it carries. We'll discuss the growth in Cincinnati's investment fund from the sale of its railway, and we'll hear how school districts in Southwest Ohio did on the latest school report cards. We've got a lot to talk about today, and some of the organizations we'll be discussing are financial supporters of Cincinnati Public Radio, including the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber and Cincinnati Public Schools. Joining me now to get the news review started is Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
We appreciate your being here. We've talked about Issue 1 on the Ohio ballot a number of times on this program, but remind us again just briefly what Issue 1 is and what it would do if passed.
It would change Ohio's method of drawing new congressional and legislative maps every 10 years. So after every census, Ohio, like every other state, has to redraw congressional legislative districts because people move, and you don't want one district to have a whole lot more people than another district. The current redistricting system, which was put in place by voters in 2015 and 2018, has come under a lot of criticism from Democrats and some Republicans who say that it's gerrymandered in favor of Republicans. Republicans right now have 10 of 15 congressional districts in Ohio, as well as the largest supermajorities in the state legislature that either party has had since the legislature went to single-member districts in the 60s. So the argument is, instead of having statewide officials and state lawmakers draw it, as they currently do, put it in the hands of this Citizens Redistricting Commission. It'd be 15 members, five Democrats, five Republicans, five independents. Part of that commission would be picked by a panel of retired judges, and then those members would then pick their colleagues, the other members of the board.
Last time we talked about this on the show, the Ohio Ballot Board had approved ballot summary language that supporters of Issue 1 characterized as inaccurate. What were some of the points in that language that the Citizens Not Politicians group objected to?
This is language that appears on everyone's ballot. Instead of listing the entire rather legalese constitutional amendment, it's a summary designed to inform voters of, hey, here's what you're voting on. And the language approved by the ballot board, by the Republicans on the ballot board at least, it just from the get-go, it painted this redistricting amendment proposal in not a very flattering light. So for example, just the title of the summary is called "To Create an Appointed Redistricting Commission Not Elected by or Subject to Removal by the Voters of the State." If that gives you an idea of the tone that this summary language took. It also interestingly said within the summary that this proposal would create gerrymandering, where of course supporters of the amendment say that the whole idea of this is to stop gerrymandering. So both sides are trying to capture that mantle of we're the anti-gerrymandering side.
You mentioned that this is summary language. This isn't the entire constitutional amendment that would be on people's ballots. How important is that ballot summary language?
It can be pretty important, especially, obviously, if there's a close race. There was actually a 2015 Ohio State study done, and it found that showing people various slanted ballot summary language, that it can actually sway their vote. However, the more, if there's obviously in proposals where people just there's not as much news coverage of it, or people, it gets really complex. Obviously, that can have more an effect than if there's a lot of news coverage and people are constantly bombarded with information about it. Mm-hmm. But especially in a close race, if it's down to a few percentage points, it can really make a difference, because this is what a lot of people rely on to get their main idea of what this proposal would do.
So the group Citizens Not Politicians, which supports Issue 1, is pushing for the passage of Issue 1, filed a lawsuit over that ballot language, that ballot summary language, and the Ohio Supreme Court issued its ruling this week. What did the court decide?
The court upheld, Citizens Not Politicians challenged Just about every part of the ballot language. I think there were only two sections of it that it didn't challenge from the title on down. And the Supreme Court, with two exceptions, upheld all of the Republican-authored ballot language and said, this isn't inaccurate, it's not misleading, and it's totally fine.
And the court itself, the Ohio Supreme Court, is made up of four Republicans and three Democrats. Did the decision follow party lines?
It did. It was an unsigned opinion, but the four Republicans in the court joined in the majority ruling. And some places, not only did they just say, hey, this language is okay, but they actually, in the unsigned ruling, actually said, yeah, we're looking at the dictionary definition of gerrymandering and, researching it, that this proposed redistricting amendment actually is gerrymandering.
So, for the most part, the court upheld the ballot board's language. There were a couple of places where the court said the ballot board needed to make changes. Can you tell us a little bit about those changes that were required and why the court said those changes had to be made?
Yeah, it was a couple of comparatively minor changes. It certainly wasn't the most prominent objections that citizens, not politicians, had to this. One is about the language regarding public participation. The initial ballot language said that it would, quote, limit the right of Ohio citizens to freely express their opinions to members of the commission, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, the amendment, as written, would prevent redistricting commissioners and staff from communicating with any outside person or vice versa about redistricting process or plans other than in public meetings or like via the online portal. And the whole idea of that is that you don't want redistricting commissioners meeting with power brokers behind the scenes to say, oh, we're going to draw this map to favor our candidates here, here, and here. But what the court found is that the ballot board's summary didn't include that there were other guarantees of public participation. So it requires several rounds of public hearings by the redistricting commission. It would allow public comments to be submitted online or in person. And so the ballot board was required to add those other guarantees of public participation that they didn't initially include in their summary.
And the ballot board made those changes that the court required this week, as I understand it. How did Democrats on the ballot board respond to all this?
They're not happy. I think it's safe to say they were just they not only Democrats there, but Democrats on the Ohio Supreme Court. And in response to the ruling, not only were very critical of the ballot summary language itself, saying it was basically designed by Republicans to convince voters not to vote for this, but they were very strongly against the Ohio Supreme Court's ruling that most of this language could stand. I believe Justice Jennifer Bruner, one of the Democratic justices who wrote the dissent in the case, said it was one of the most stilted ballot summary languages she's ever seen, or something to that effect.
Can the Citizens Not Politicians group, this group that's pushing for the passage of Issue 1, can they challenge this new language in court, the tweaks that the ballot board made this week, or has the ballot board for sure finalized the summary language that Ohio voters will see on their ballots?
I suppose they could, but Frank LaRose, who chairs the ballot board, he's the Ohio Secretary of State. His office not only wrote most of the ballot summary language initially, but then wrote these revisions as well. They narrowly tailored what the additional language was, and they said they actually pulled directly from the court opinion itself to make sure that it wouldn't be challenged in the court again. Also, ballots are already going out. Today is the ballots were sent out for military and overseas voters. So it, if there was a lawsuit now, it's coming kind of late because there's already ballots being sent out with this language on it.
We've talked a little bit about party lines and how the ballot board is dominated by Republicans, the legislature is dominated by Republicans. This might sound like a real basic question, but can you just explain for people who haven't been following this as closely why so many Republicans, not all Republicans, but why so many Republicans oppose Issue 1 and so many Democrats support it?
because the ultimate outcome of this, it's widely expected that this will, if this passes, Democrats will gain congressional and legislative seats, a significant number, and Republicans will lose seats. Mm-hmm. Right now, as I said, Republicans have 10 of 15 congressional districts. It's predicted that if this passes, Democrats will get two more of those congressional seats. There might be a competitive district or two, but it's expected that Democrats will pick up one or two seats. In the legislature, it'll probably mean about 8 or 9 seats, more Democratic seats than they have now, as well as a handful of Senate seats. So when it comes down to it, it's really about just power. And just Democrats think that Republicans have a disproportionate amount of power, and this will help them get it back. Republicans say this is just a power grab by Democrats, and that they won these elections fair and square, and they're trying to slant the rules so Democrats can have a disproportionate amount of seats for themselves.
And I guess the question is how these districts reflect the voting public, how the public breaks down in terms of Democrats and Republicans. Is that the big question here?
Yeah, the interesting thing about this is that while the argument made by Citizens Not Politicians is this would create fairer districts, the goal here is not to create more competitive districts. The whole idea of this amendment of this proposed redistricting system is the whole underpinning of it is that the new redistricting commission would have to draw districts, both congressional and legislative districts, that are slanted toward one party or another in proportion to what the average statewide vote that statewide candidates from each party got in recent elections. So what that means is, for example, let's say Republican statewide candidates for governor or Senate got 55% of the vote on average in the last few elections. Well, this redistricting commission would have to draw maps where 55% of congressional districts favored Republicans and yet 45% would favor Democrats. And same for the legislature. So that would be the underpinning of the goal of these redistricting maps. And Republicans say, well, that's gerrymandering because there's now this quota that the redistricting commission has to fill where the goal is not to draw competitive districts, it's to draw districts that meet this overall quota for what the parties break down. And Democrats say, well, you know, right now Republicans hold these vast supermajorities, and this will actually cut down and make it reflect what the actual partisan breakdown is in Ohio.
Michigan voters passed a redistricting measure 6 years ago. How similar was that plan to what Ohio voters will be considering in the form of issue one?
It's pretty similar to the extent that even the main group backing that Michigan redistricting plan, instead of Citizens Not Politicians, which is the Ohio redistricting activist group, it was called Voters Not Politicians. And it also created a citizen redistricting board divided among Democrats, Republicans, and independents. There were some differences. For example, instead of having a panel of retired judges, anyone who applied for this commission, they just picked names out of a hat and just picked members of the commission. But there's a couple of things that Ohio can learn from Michigan's experience. One is that just like we've been talking about, it didn't result in more competitive districts in Michigan. It resulted in Democrats picking up seats to the point that Democrats won the state legislature and they won the House there for the first time since the 1980s. But it didn't create more districts where both Republicans and Democrats actually had a realistic chance of each of them winning. Another takeaway is Black representation. It had the result after the redistricting plan there passed of fewer Black lawmakers, both in the state legislature. Detroit lost. It didn't have a Black congressman or doesn't have a Black congressperson for the first time in a very long time. And there was actually a lawsuit brought, a federal lawsuit brought against the redistricting plan there, saying that the way the districts were drawn were actually reduced, violated the Voting Rights Act, because they would take urban Black majority neighborhoods and draw it in with white, richer, more affluent neighborhoods in the suburbs. And talking with experts there, it seems that given Ohio has this quota basically for how many districts should favor each party, that it's even more likely that that would be a problem or an issue, at least in Ohio, if this passes, and would probably even be more likely to result in some sort of lawsuit over that.
Well, Jeremy, you've been very, very informative. I've been talking with Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Up next, Hamilton County has a new vision for what a renovated Bengals stadium could look like. We'll hear what it entails and what it could cost. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. This week, we got the first glimpse of what a renovated Paycor Stadium could look like. But will the Bengals play ball? Joining me now to talk about that and other important news from the past week are WVXU reporter and senior editor Tana Weingartner and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Tana and Becca.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy.
So great to have you in the studio. Tana, let's talk Paycor Stadium. Hamilton County unveiled this new vision for the Bengals stadium complex. What's the impetus for this big renovation plan?
So, as a lot of people know, the team and the county are in negotiations about a new lease. The current lease, which everyone agrees, well, maybe everyone except for the Bengals, a lot of people say is terrible. It's, you know, been labeled the worst lease in NFL. And that's coming up. It's going to run out in 2026. So they're beginning to look at negotiating after that. And so the county commissioners, Hamilton County commissioners, basically said, you know, we hate the lease deal. We need a new deal. What would the stadium need to look like in the future to keep the team here long term, but not do all of this nickel and diming fixing that we've been doing, you know, for the last 20 years?
And you mentioned that the county commissioners are not a fan of this lease. Could the Bengals opt to extend the current lease? Is that
right.
One of the things on the table?
Yeah. Well, it's not on the table. It just kind of exists. I guess it is a thing. They can extend it for basically 10 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So under the current terms, yes.
Okay. Let's talk about this new vision. Tell us about the new training center that's part of the proposal.
Right. So the whole proposal, and it's just a vision, right? Like, let's be clear. This is, you know, they asked for the design firm to create a vision of what it could be like. So this is not set in stone. The Bengals haven't offered any feedback on it yet, to our knowledge. It's $1.25 billion. The training center would go, you know, where the current sort of area is. The bubble goes away. You get an actual indoor full field training center. You get an outdoor with two fields and a 2,000 seat stadium for that. And then this proposal suggests that they move all of the administrative stuff out of the current Paycor Stadium and over into this new facility with the indoor training. And we can talk later about what that frees up then at the stadium. And then, you know, like workout equipment and all sorts of stuff over in that facility.
What this would require changes to the street grid too, right? Kind of walk us through that.
Yeah, so the proposal suggests that, you know, we would just kind of cut off Central Avenue. It wouldn't go all the way through to Maring anymore, and that would become pedestrian. You know, right now when the team goes over to practice, they have to walk across the street. So basically they'll reclaim the street there as part of the complex and then push Maring Way a little bit to the south because Hilltop is going to relocate at some point. I don't know, Becca probably knows better offhand when Hilltop's going, but so, you know, they would kind of take that land to push Marion closer to the river and then have some space there as well.
Yeah, Hilltop, that concrete manufacturing
yes.
place that's been on the riverfront for
Thank you, Lucy,
years and years
for
and years
bailing
years.
Us out by knowing more.
No, sure thing. You mentioned that this vision would move some stuff out of the current Paycor Stadium into this new, like the offices and
yes.
things, into this new practice facility that's being envisioned. What does that mean for changes inside Paycor Stadium?
So one of the things that, you know, the new stadium, so basically one of the tenets of the lease that everyone hates is if a certain number, if it's like half of stadiums in the NFL have something nice, then the Bengals get to have it too. So, you know, well, the big thing now is like really fancy boxes and suites and clubs and spaces like that. So where the administrative offices are now, that would come out and that would free up space to do, you know, a club area for some of the lower bowl seating. And then that would not like look out onto the field. So that's, you know, just like a lower tier of fancy seating. But then throughout the stadium, the proposal as written doesn't call for eliminating any seats, but it does open up a lot more of suites around some of the seating. And, you know, all the current areas where you can go, the current suites would get a facelift because they're a little dated and they maybe aren't laid out to function quite as well. And they also don't usually, they look out on the city or they look out on the river. Some of these plans call for opening, like taking out some of the seating so that they look into the stadium, and then that seating would get relocated elsewhere.
And it sounds like if it's more fancy seating, more suites, club seats, whatever, that could present more money-making opportunities for the Bengals, right?
Right.
Is that part of the
I mean, I think that's probably part of what might entice them to liking it, right?
Yeah.
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 So, which I'll, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, you go ahead.
Well, no, I'm going to jump, so.
Okay. So what's the long-term goal of all this? You mentioned the commissioners are really interested in having a deal that keeps the Bengals in town for a long time without as right. many requirements. Is that the goal of this whole thing?
Yeah. So right now, as I said, basically whatever the Bengals want, the Bengals get under the lease because they're required to and the county taxpayers have to pay it. And the idea, as stated, is, you know, like, we'll do this big change. Not we, the county, will do. Like, here's our presented plan, and we will have to come up with some sort of shared funding plan for that. And then, you know, like, create a space that the Bengals want to be in, that they want to stay. And then, you know, we'll have a lease that will be more equitable to the county, to the taxpayers, to the team. And, you know, they want the commissioners would like to see buy-in from the NFL and money from the state as well to pay for, you know, all these potential renovations and, you know, the lease moving forward, and that the county would get back more on its dime and be able to do more with the building, which it owns, and you get some of that return on their investment that they currently don't get.
Okay. So you had said that the estimated cost of this vision is $1.25 billion.
Right.
A lot of money. And the county's saying, hey, if this goes through, we don't want taxpayers to be footing the bill for this. We want lots of money from the Bengals, from the NFL, and from the state. We want help from more partners to make this happen.
Exactly. And that, you know, and to be clear, the commissioners have also said, like, this isn't where we're starting. Like, this isn't the plan. Like, what it all has to start with is a new lease. So nothing, you know, nothing happens until a new lease is kind of in the thing. I feel like this is, you know, sort of a bargaining tool. Like, hey, you know, we're interested in maybe investing alongside you in what this could be. So don't you want to stay, but with a lease that's more equitable.
Okay. What were some of the initial reactions that you heard from county commissioners about this vision? What did they say about it?
Yeah, they seemed to like the idea. You know, again, they had asked for to present what would make this, you know, state of the art and, you know, kind of whatever setup. Circulation was something that was important for them, you know, because right now, kind of getting around the stadium, there's lots of bottlenecks and the access points are limited and there's lots of stairs and things that kind of limit how you can get in, and lots of backups to get into the stadium. So it would kind of lift the plaza up. It would make circulation be easier. It would also make it more accessible for people who have accessibility needs. And so that's obviously a win-win. And that was something that was super key to the commissioners, especially Commissioner Stephanie Summer-Dumas pointed that out, was really important to her.
Mm-hmm. What's the next step with all this? Do I understand they want feedback from the public about this vision?
Right. So it's kind of a multi-step thing. So it obviously you have to send it over to the Bengals and say, hey, what do you guys think? But commissioners are more interested in saying, you know, wanting some public feedback as well. You know, they seem pretty happy with it. It seemed like from the meeting, a little unclear if they're going to have many, if any, big substantial changes to what was, you know, proposed by this design firm. You know, maybe have a meeting that the public can come to in the evening and, you know, see the presentation and hear kind of what the idea is. But obviously, negotiating the lease is the big, big next step.
Yep. That's job one.
Job one is to get a better lease.
Okay. Well, Becca, I want to turn to you next and talk about another issue that had a lot of residents of Cincinnati very passionate, and that is the sale of the Cincinnati Southern Railway. We haven't talked to you about that for a while. We've given you a little break.
I've certainly thought about it a lot.
I know you have. But there was news this week, so tell us about the news.
Yeah, so the Board of Trustees that previously oversaw the city's ownership of the railway and the lease to Norfolk Southern has transitioned to now overseeing the investment fund that the $1.6 billion payment for selling the railway has been invested, and they're overseeing that process. That involved hiring a financial management firm to kind of make the day-to-day decisions about investment, and they gave an update to the Railroad Board this week on how that trust fund is doing. And the short answer is it's doing very well, about a little bit above projections in terms of the return on the investment.
So doing a little bit better than they had even hoped. How much of that money will the Board of Trustees be paying to the city? What does that amount to in terms of dollars going to the city of Cincinnati?
Yeah, so the total amount that the fund has grown by is about $94 million. So that's almost 6%, about 5.9%. Now, from the beginning, the board had always said they didn't plan to give the city all of the funding or all of the additional revenue that came in. So the goal was to give 3.5% of the growth. And so this year that works out to $56 million. Now, this notably is not going to the city for a little while. The city needs a lot of lead time to prepare that budget. And so the requirement was that the board would make a decision on how much to give the city by the end of September for fiscal year 2026. So this means the fiscal year starting July 1st, 2025, and going through to the end of June of 2026.
Man, that fiscal year stuff, it always
so annoying. Honestly, I roll my eyes every time I have to explain it.
What do we know about how the city's planning to use that money?
Yeah, so something as far back as a year ago, when voters were considering whether to sell the railway, the city administration put forward a kind of tentative plan for how they would spend the money. Now, legally, they have to spend it on maintaining existing infrastructure, so they can't build anything new with it. The kind of exception to that is, let's say there's a fire station that's not in good enough condition to repair. The city could, for example, build a new fire station to completely replace that fire station, but otherwise, it's maintaining lots of things like streets, sidewalks in some cases, parks and recreation facilities, that kind of thing. So that plan was over a 10-year period. So there are lots of projects on that list that are not going to be on the project list for this year, or for next year rather. But there is a plan, and that's linked on our web story if anybody wants to check out more details on that.
Okay, on WVXU.org. So you mentioned the fund grew by, I think you said, $94 million.
That's right.
And a chunk of that's going to the city based on the plan that was laid out. What happens to the rest of that money? Is the Railway Board trying to grow the trust fund's principal? Tell us about that.
Exactly that, yeah. So obviously it started at $1.6 billion. The goal is to, you know, increase that principal little by little every year so that the returns keep growing as well. Obviously, ideally, the more you invest, the more you can get in returns as well. So it's sort of three main goals they have are obviously giving some money to the city so that they can use it for infrastructure. That's the main purpose of the fund, so they don't want to skip out on that. Growing that trust fund balance, partly just to keep up with inflation, because obviously that's been a big topic lately, and it's something that is going to affect the fund and how much that money is able to be spent. The other is to sort of create this reserve, like a cushion, for if the returns next year are lower than 5.5%, which is what the goal is, or if it's even negative. It's completely possible that the returns could be negative one year. The goal is to have an average 5.5% increase over time, but it's really common for these to be kind of up and down. So if there's a year where the returns are less or even negative, a cushion in that fund would allow the board to still give the city of Cincinnati some money. There is sort of a legal minimum threshold that they have to give the city money every year, except for in very unlikely dire situations with the fund. But the goal is that, you know, even if things are not looking so good for the fund, there would be enough of a cushion to still give the city a significant amount.
Mm-hmm. And just to remind people who maybe have lost track of this or weren't paying attention to the railway sale, the idea is that this fund will generate more money for the city each year than the old lease with Norfolk Southern did, right?
That's correct. Now, what we have to compare that to is the most recent lease, which was about to expire. So the $56 million dollars that the city will get for fiscal year 2026. That's more than double what the city was getting under the most recent lease. Now, you'll hear folks say, and this is totally true, that, you know, it is possible that the city could have negotiated a higher lease payment for, you know, moving forward. But that the Norfolk Southern never responded to a lease negotiation. So it was a more than a year, I think almost 2 years of negotiations between the two of them. And that whole time, Norfolk Southern was really set on buying. And so we really don't know what that, you know, possible lease payment would have looked like.
Okay. Well, it's not just the railway fund that's growing. A new report out this week is expecting the region's population to grow, too. Tell us about that, Becca.
That's right. So this is from the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. It's their third State of the Region report. It's basically just a deep dive into a lot of census and other statistical data looking at the region. So this is not just specific to the city of Cincinnati. There's sort of a 15-county region in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana, and it's looking at all of those. And so the sort of status quo prediction. So that's if things stay on track the way they are now and no major policy or economic things change, the region is expected to add about 248,000 new residents by 2050.
What are some of the factors? This report, am I correct that this was put together by the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber?
Yes.
What are some of the factors the chamber says will help determine if the region grows a lot, a little, or at all?
Yeah. So like I said, that kind of baseline prediction is the status quo as, you know, things kind of remain steady. There's a low growth scenario, and that's if things in the economy really just don't do well. Now, the high growth scenario is the one that they say that, you know, local policymakers have some control over. So it's this idea that if what they call pro-growth policies are enacted, the region could actually add, up to 600,000 new residents. So quite a significant higher number. The biggest policy that they're looking at there is housing. The city is not current, or the region rather, also the city, but the region as a whole, is not building enough housing to keep up with the number of residents that are being added. And obviously that leads to higher prices for housing as well. So a big focus is going to be on, can the region build enough housing to keep up with it? Because if folks can't afford to move here, they're not going to move here.
Mm-hmm. The report also found Cincinnati ranks in the top half of peer cities for a percentage of population that is Gen Z, but the bottom half of peer cities for millennials. Walk us through that and explain what that says to the people who put this study together. Why is it important to point that out?
Yeah, so the chamber's interpretation of that is the city is doing, or the region rather, is doing a good job of bringing young folks here out of high school to study at the universities and colleges in the area, but that the region is not necessarily doing a great job of keeping those folks here after they graduate. Now, obviously, time will tell if that trend continues, but the idea is that, you know, we're doing a good job of attracting that kind of younger generation to at least check out Cincinnati and greater Cincinnati region. But, you know, we're not doing a great job of keeping them here for jobs and sort of contributing to the economy in a way that the chamber would like to see.
And this found younger generations in the region are becoming more diverse, too. What does that mean for the region?
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting graph, actually. And you can see the chamber's data visualized on our website, again, at WVXU.org. But the silent generation, for example, the oldest, you know, living generation right now is almost 86% white. Gen Alpha, which is just, you know, younger than Gen Z, is only about 61% white. So definitely getting more diverse. Each generation has been more and more diverse. But we heard, in terms of trying to retain those younger generations in the area as well, that as the population gets more diverse, that our cultural amenities need to be more diverse as well. We heard from the Urban League of Greater Southwestern Ohio on this topic that, you know, it's not the only consideration, but if we have a more diverse younger population, but they don't feel that the culture in the area is representative of who they are and representative of their culture, then there's going to be a high incentive to go somewhere else where they can find that culture.
The report also pointed out some racial disparities, didn't it?
Yeah, and this is an example where, you know, obviously the goal of the report is to highlight the ways that the Cincinnati area is growing and doing well. This is an area where the region has made negative progress, you know, compared to the last couple of reports. So the median Black household in Greater Cincinnati makes more than $40,000 less than the median white household. That's a really, really large gap. Compared to our peer cities, we're in the bottom 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We're like sixth to last in that. And we dropped a few ranks compared to last year. Unemployment is also not distributed equally. And this is something that, you know, if you look at the visualizations from the report, all of our peer cities have a significant racial wealth gap. So it is a problem that's happening everywhere. But in terms of Cincinnati, you know, the goal is progress and shortening that gap. The region did not manage to do that this over the past year. And so that's definitely something that needs greater focus.
We've mentioned peer cities a couple times, and yeah. I think the chamber usually tries really hard not to compare Cincinnati to like New York City or Chicago, you know, or Los Angeles or some of these giant cities that are that don't have a lot in common with us. What are the peer cities in this study?
Yeah, so I won't list all of them because there's quite a few, but there'll be ones that are really familiar to folks. The other major cities in Ohio, like Dayton, Columbus, Cleveland, that kind of thing. Also looking at Louisville, Nashville, Tennessee, Charlotte, North Carolina, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Indianapolis, a few others. So some of these, like, you know, Dallas and Houston, I think in particular, are quite a bit larger population wise. But do remember, we're talking about metro area, not just city. So when you look at that, Cincinnati is, I think, the 30th or 31st largest metro area in the U.S. So that does change a little bit what we mean when we say peer city, because we're really talking about peer metro area.
OK, that makes sense. And here are the three of us, people who grew up in this region.
That's right.
We are not Gen X. I hope I don't offend anybody by saying that. I know.
Wait a minute.
Aren't you Gen X?
I'm Gen X.
Are you Gen X?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, I'm
sorry.
Okay. I'm sorry. I meant we're not Gen Z.
Yeah.
I'm Gen X.
I was going to say, you should be Gen X.
I'm Gen X.
Yeah. How old are we?
Yeah. What? How do we label it? But we're all here.
Like, we are here.
We didn't.
And I came back. I left and I came back.
So did I.
You're welcome,
Cincinnati. I came back. Yeah. Yeah. So
I stayed.
We need a yeah.
Good for you.
We need a little.
That's what they want to see.
Yeah. We need a footnote in the chamber to report there about us or something. Okay. Well, I have been talking with WVXU reporter and senior editor Tana Weingartner and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you both so much for your time today.
The highlight of my day, Lucy.
Aww,
same. Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you. Up next, we'll hear how Southwest Ohio schools did on the latest state report cards. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The state of Ohio released the 2024 school report cards, and the results were mixed for school districts in Southwest Ohio, with some districts getting the highest possible marks and others falling short of the state's standard. Joining me now to discuss how local districts fared is WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Zach.
Good to be here, Lucy.
Always great to have you. Zach, these school report cards were released last Friday. What's the state looking at with this? What are they trying to measure?
Yeah, so this is coming from data from the previous school year, so the one that would have wrapped up before the start of summer. And basically what they're measuring there is things like academic achievement, academic progress, early literacy, and graduation rates. And it basically takes all of that data and then gives that a rating and then takes all of that and puts it into a 5-star rating. So 1 out of 5 stars, 1 being low and 5 being the highest.
Okay, so 5 stars, that's what everybody wants if you want an A+. So let's talk about the Southwest Ohio school districts. How many got that top score, all 5 stars?
So there were 10 that got the highest score possible. That's Forest Hills, Madeira, Loveland, Marymount, Sycamore, Wyoming, Ross, Mason, Springboro, and Wayne school districts. They all earned 5 stars, very similar to last year's rating, very, very small differences there.
Okay. How many failed to reach the 3-star benchmark? Because I understand that the state would like every district to be at least 3 stars, right?
Yep. 3 is the benchmark there. That is kind of the cutoff for what the state standard is. So anything at 3 or above 3 is considered really good. That's considered meeting the standard. Anything above that is exceeding. So Cincinnati Public Schools, which had 2.5, they were close, but not quite there to that 3-star rating. Lockland, Mount Healthy, North College Hill, which I will say went to a 4-day week this past school year. So it's kind of interesting to see their rating on that. St. Bernard, Elmwood, Winton Woods, and Middletown, they all scored below that 3-star. So either 2 stars or 2.5 for those school districts.
You mentioned Cincinnati Public Schools got that 2.5-star rating. Did CPS show improvement?
They did, yeah. So the previous year, they had 2 stars, and this most recent rating is 2.5. So they did have that half-star improvement, which is a pretty big deal for them. I spoke to the superintendent last week about this, and, you know, overall, they're you know, pretty happy about it. Of course, there are some areas where there's concern, and I think a lot of those concerns are shared by some of the larger, more urban districts in the state. Things like chronic absenteeism, the graduation rate, literacy, even though they got 2 stars on that this year, they got 1 star on it last year. You know, it's still an area where they're trying to improve.
You mentioned that you talked to the interim superintendent. What did she say overall? I mean, about just how the district did.
Yeah, she says, you know, this is a step in the right direction, and particularly that early literacy was a big point of pride for them. We may have talked about the science of reading and kind of how that's been implemented. CPS has actually been using the science of reading for some years now, so that change hasn't had a huge effect on their early literacy, but they've seen some progress in there. So 13% improvement in K-3 literacy rates, and then a 10% jump in third grade reading proficiency. So a pretty noticeable bump there. So they were pretty proud of that. They want to keep that momentum going, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Are there other areas where the district showed improvements?
Yeah, so they improved the graduation rate slightly. They have been working on that. They have graduation counselors just trying to make sure students have a plan and kind of know what that end goal is at the end of high school. So it was a small improvement, about, I think, 1%, if I remember correctly, on that graduation rate. And then also chronic absenteeism, which has been a huge issue, not just for CPS, but really every school district around the state. I believe it's something about a quarter of students in the state of Ohio in every single district, you know, we're talking about
on
every
average,
single,
yeah.
On average, is considered chronically absent, and that's missing 10% of the school year. So CPS went from 46% chronically absent last year to 43% in these most recent ratings. So small improvement. They're definitely still not happy about where that is, but small steps in the right direction.
And 10% of the school year, that ends up being like 17 or 18 school days that mm-hmm. kids are missing if they're chronically absent, right?
Yeah. And this can be missing school for any reason. So kind of looking at CPS's data and who is chronically absent, we're looking at Black students. We're looking at economically disadvantaged students who make up economically disadvantaged, 49% are considered chronically absent. So that's very high. And also students with disabilities. This can be, you know, physical disability, mental disability. That's 52% of those disabled students are chronically absent. And they've talked about this before. You know, if you're a student with a disability, maybe you have an appointment, a doctor's appointment, special care that you need. If you have to miss school for that, that still counts as being absent. So that's where the district is running into challenges when you have all these outside factors outside the school that lead to chronic absenteeism.
You mentioned that, you know, the interim superintendent said, hey, we're moving in the right direction. Are there other things that Cincinnati Public Schools has done or is doing that she expects will lead to more improvement?
Yeah, they've had these kind of attendance counselors as well. They implemented that, I believe, a few years ago, just trying to build these connections with students, because it's really been a problem, absenteeism since the pandemic especially. So they're really trying to make those connections with students, really trying to make the school environment more welcoming, more of a place where they want to be. It's been really slow progress with that, but progress nonetheless. And they're encountering, you know, more challenges. Student homelessness went up again this year. We're looking at 2,861 students in the school district of CPS are considered to be homeless or having housing instability. So that can be a big contributor to not only absenteeism, but, you know, academic success. So these are kind of things some of the the larger districts in the state are facing that smaller suburban districts don't have. And, you know, CPS says there's something to be proud of. 2.5 stars, while that's not meeting the state standard, when you look at those eight urban districts, that's Cleveland, Columbus, Toledo, Akron, Canton, Dayton, and Youngstown, they're kind of on the upper threshold of that. Cleveland had 3 stars this year, which is the highest of those districts. And, you know, CPS was right behind them with 2.5.
What about some of the changes the district's made in terms of where students are educated in school facilities? We talked to the interim superintendent a few weeks ago about the establishment of a middle school. Does she think that those kinds of changes are going to help?
Yeah, they introduced Schroeder Middle School this year, and this has been a big thing for the interim superintendent, trying to create these different learning spaces to have more of a focus on specific grade levels. So previously, before this, those, you know, 7th and 8th graders were in the high school building. Now they're in their own building. And she's hoping that this is going to create an environment that's not only safer for middle school students, but also more of a focused, nurturing learning environment. So there's one middle school right now, and she says there could be more on the way soon.
You mentioned Cincinnati Public Schools is one of these big urban districts in Ohio. Those districts are very different from, say, a Sycamore, a more suburban district, in terms of the challenges they face. What's your sense for whether CPS officials think this is really a fair assessment of how their schools are doing, considering those different challenges they have?
Yeah, and they say this pretty much every year, is that this we're judging these schools on the same grading scale when you have just different economic environments and so many different factors that can contribute to student success. It's not just what's happening inside of the classroom. It's not necessarily on the teachers or anything like that. There are just real-world factors there that are contributing to this. They're trying to work on that in ways they can, but some things inside the home, it's out of their control.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Zach, thank you so much for your time today.
Always good to be here.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.